Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 96. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, eBooks, YouTube, and it's going to be in the blog section of libertarianinstitute.org. I want to remind you about my book, Freedom Through Memedom, The 31-Day Guide to Waking Up to Liberty. It's available on Amazon. It's available for Kindle as well as paperback. If you choose the Kindle option, you can download it in a couple seconds. And if you're signed up for Kindle Unlimited, you can download it for free. Today, I am talking to Anthony Samaroff. We talk about a bunch of subjects, but we start off talking about Count Dankula. We talk about Lauren Southern not being allowed to enter the UK. And we get into some conversations about blowback and radical Islam. We talk about a bunch of things. So I'm going to let Anthony plug the things that he has going on right in the beginning. So let's just jump into this without any further delay. Here is Anthony Samaroff. So how are you doing today, Anthony?
Great. Thank you, Mance, for having me on Free Man Beyond the Wall. I love what you're doing. You're a unique voice in liberty and the interesting topics you choose for your podcast. You've always got something slightly esoteric or outside of the norm to talk about, and I think that's great.
Well, I do appreciate that. I know that you are in Scotland and you have your own podcast, and go ahead and tell us right now what you're doing over there.
Sure. Yeah, I'm known for being the co-host of the Scottish Liberty podcast along with Tom Laird. And that came to people's attentions on the Tom Woods show and School Sucks and other things like that. And I also have a personal development podcast called Be Yourself, and which people can also check out in iTunes if they're interested in personal development. In fact, you can find links to everything that I do in my free book, Procrastination Annihilation, which you download from beyourselfandloveit.com/do-it. In that book, I've got links to both my podcasts and all my other work. So if people like me, then they'll know where to find me.
Excellent. I'm glad we could get that. I'm glad you could get that out up front so people can check it out. All right. So when we decided that we were going to talk, I obviously, with you being in Scotland, I wanted to talk to you about everything that's happening with Count Dankula. So I guess what I would first ask is that a good example of what the culture has come to in Great Britain?
I think it's definitely in the leash of what the culture has come to. Recently, Lauren Southern, the alt-right YouTuber, was banned from the UK for a stunt she pulled where they handed out flyers saying that Allah was for gays as well as straight people, and Allah could have been a gay god, which was a satire of something that was done about Jesus. Her being a Christian, she took offense to, or umbrage to that, and wanted to show the double standard. And yes, she was unceremoniously banned from the UK. Count Dankula taught a pug to do a salute in response to the term Zeke Heil and Gas the Jews. Okay, pretty untasteful. However, it was a joke. He did it to annoy his girlfriend, and he said up front, my girlfriend cares more about her dog than me. She keeps on saying how cute it is. So I thought, what's the least cute thing in the world? Well, a Nazi. So I'm going to teach her cute dog to be a Nazi. At no point would anyone think that this was inciting racial hatred. An off-taste joke, but do you know what we do with off-taste jokes? We just don't expose themselves to them. If you don't like the jokes that people make, you can decide not to associate with that person. Hell, you can tell other people to associate with him. He says unsavory things. But I think locking someone up at public expense for what amounts to an off-taste joke is frankly ridiculous. And yeah, we've got social justice warrior culture here. I don't know whether we're ahead or behind you, but we've had protests on campuses here, maybe not to the degree in the West. I certainly know that Edinburgh is a hotbed for teaching the radical intersectional version of feminism, teaching people that they're oppressed, and they're largely middle class people who've got good incomes and are getting their education for free. By the way, you get higher education for free in the UK, which basically is tantamount people taxing working class people who go straight out of school into a job and work for their education. So it's like, yeah, I mean, if that's your definition of oppressed, looting other people for your personal benefit, then we've gone quite a long, a far way down. I don't think that people realize how lucky they are to live in the 21st century where you know, you've got a flush toilet, a vacuum cleaner, a dishwasher, a washing machine. You've got huge amounts of leisure time, which you can choose to do anything you want with. All the music's free online, podcasts, everything. You can learn skills. It's like the notion. Okay, there is a form of oppression because if you do get a job, you're taxed at an extraordinary rate on your income. I think that at this stage, anyone would coming forth. And here's the ironic thing. It's like if you work for a capitalist who gives you a job, apparently he's oppressing you. But, you know, the government, even though that's voluntary, but the government taxing you 30, 40, 50% of your income, which isn't voluntary, that's not oppression. Do you know what I mean? So that's one form. We've got the economic oppression and obviously the crackdowns on free speech. I'm really pleased that Oxford University Union, one of the most prestigious universities in the country, is having the most controversial speakers come to their union to give talks and answer Q&As and then putting them in YouTube. In this climate, to see that is awesome. They've had Ann Coulter, someone that I'm not a huge fan of because of her advocacy for the wars, but it's great that she's having them. Tommy Robinson, a person who's been very outspoken about Muslim culture in the UK, and he's been attacked for his views. Some people say he's a racist, but whatever you think of him, they had him give a talk and they put it on YouTube. So I'm glad to see that there's some bastions of sanity within the university system in the UK where they're saying, well, why don't we actually listen to people what they have to say, and we can ask critical questions afterwards. And most of the questions were critical. So there's good things and bad things happening.
All right. There's a bunch of questions that could be asked about what you just said. I guess one of the first questions I want to ask is, when it comes to this culture of, you know, watch what you say, you can get in trouble, has that invaded private business and corporation over there? Is it, has this kind of
not
go ahead.
I've not heard of anyone being asked to bake a gay wedding cake and refusing in the UK. I don't think we're even as religious here as you guys are over in the States, broadly speaking. However, there's things like a supermarket don't have anything labelled Easter eggs. They're only labelled holiday eggs or whatever, chocolate eggs. I think, and that's again, you know, oh, Easter, it's not secular. So I think, I mean, I'm from a Jewish background myself, and even though I'm a heathen, right? And my co-host the other day made some joke when we were covering Dankula, right? Okay, and I laughed, you know, some off-taste joke about us people having big noses or something like that. Now, someone can choose not to listen into our podcast after hearing that. But the reason I remark on it is a friend of mine saying, seriously, does Tam feel safe making a joke like that on the internet under the current climate? And the worrying thing is, as you say, watch what you say. It's the threat of force being used against you for saying unsavory things. It's not that it's being applied continuously. It's the fear that people will just shut up. People will just not say unpopular views because they're afraid of the backlash, you know? And, you know, I experienced some of that myself when I was at university. I made some off-color joke on Facebook and I got mobbed for it, partly by people who went to my university. I wasn't expecting it. And it made me seriously scared to post certain things for a couple of years. It was scary because this was before the whole social justice warrior culture had manifested as a phenomenon, right? Nowadays, I would have just been like, lol, yeah, I'm so sexist. You know, I'm sure I'm sexist because obviously anyone who knows me knows that. And, you know, I had messages from female friends being like, telling me, this is ridiculous, Anthony. You're the least sexist person I know. But the thing is, at the time, it was scary. Now, whenever anyone calls someone a racist online, they're just like, haha, yeah, whatever. This is what the social justice warriors have done, because there are some people who actually are racists, but they've made the word racist and Nazi and anti-Islamophobic, they've made these words completely and utterly meaningless because they just throw them around so flagrantly. So I guess we don't really know how badly it's affecting business, to answer your question, because we don't know what people are not doing that they would otherwise be doing if it wasn't for this culture. Because it's a culture of silence.
Mm. All right, then let's talk about, you mentioned Lauren Southern. I had a question about that. I know she's a Canadian citizen, and they're under the crown. Say she wasn't a controversial figure or anything like that. Is travel between Canada and Great Britain just basically open? You don't need to need a passport or anything like that?
No, I think you need a passport to travel. It's very, very difficult to immigrate from North America or Australia or New Zealand to the UK. It's like, if you come from anywhere in the European Union, you can immigrate here easily. We took quite a lot of Syrian refugees in, but it's really, really weird. It's like, it's very difficult for people to immigrate from English-speaking nations to other English-speaking nations. I mean, I've got a friend working in New York. It was really, really difficult for him to get a green card. Like, I don't know why this is. I mean, it gives credence to these conspiracy theories about, you know, the alt-right conspiracy theories about the death of Western civilization and stuff like that. And it's not a death, it's like suicide. I mean, we spend ridiculous amounts of money locking people up for victimless crimes. We go and bomb the crap out of the Middle East, creating refugee crises, then let all the people in with no integration policy, no way of teaching them English, so they don't have skills, they can't easily get a job. It's like, you know, what the hell are we doing? Like, and you're not allowed to speak about this stuff, because if you speak about it, then you're Islamophobic, right?
That's not even a word.
Yeah.
I don't even recognize that as a word. It's one of those buzzwords that somebody created just so that they could demonize other people.
Right. And it's like, the thing is, a phobia is an irrational fear, okay? There is something like 2 billion Muslims in the world, and it's like, even if there's a percentage of them, right, who would think that I deserve the death sentence for saying this, for just saying this, right? Because you're not allowed to slander Islam. Now, even if that's 0.1%, that's still millions of people in the world. Now, see if you went down to the bar tonight, Mance, and a friend of yours was like, hey, Mance, there was a guy in here that said, have you seen Mance around recently? And they were like, no, he's not been in for a while. He's like, well, see, when you do see him, tell him that I'm going to come and I'm going to kick his head in, right? You'd be scared. You'd be scared of that, right?
Yeah.
So the fact that there's literally millions of people in the world who think that me making these remarks on Islam should get me the death sentence, you know, that's not a phobia. And it's like, I technically, as a libertarian-minded person, you know, with be it not for the welfare state and free schools and hospitals and things like that, I'm for people immigrating to live wherever they choose, wherever they're able to. But under the current system, it's like you can't do that, because you're basically creating problems. And I was dragged kicking and screaming to the from being an open borders libertarian to taking a more I'd say, sensible or rational view of the issue. I mean, don't get me wrong, we've got a very bright friend in the Scottish Libertarian Party who's a Muslim, and he's great. He's so bright. He's studying in Prague right now, studying Austrian economics. Like, so it's obviously, it's not really about being Muslim or anything like that. It's about, like, how can you sustain a social fact? There needs to be kind of integration policy under the current system. And I mean, some people say, well, just bring them all in and let the welfare state collapse. But it's not like the suddenly you have anarcho-capitalism. Do you know what I mean? It's not like if you burnt down all the churches, everyone would suddenly become atheists. It's ridiculous, you know?
Well, let me ask you, because I've wanted to ask people, I wanted to ask someone who's living in an area where there tends to be, you know, we've seen attacks by Islamic extremists in Great Britain. Sweden is undergoing serious problems. Why do you think it is that if a bunch of Muslims go to Sweden or they go to Great Britain, why do you think they have more of a tendency to see violence than when they come here? Because we don't.
And when they come to the States.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, we've had San Bernardino, and we've had, the Orlando shooter, you know, who claimed, who basically pointed towards, American involvement in, American, what we call blowback theory, American involvement in the Middle East. But for the most part, most of these, you know, most people who emigrate from Muslim countries and come here, they integrate a lot better and actually become, you know, have a tendency to become pretty successful and do, right, you know, do pretty well. So what do you think is the difference? I mean, is it the culture? Do we integrate better? Or, I mean, from what I've heard in Sweden, they let people in and then they just throw them into a neighborhood, which, you know, you could actually use the word ghetto from things that I've described. They don't teach them. They don't teach them Swedish. They don't teach them English, which, you know, the Swedes both speak. And then they just give them, you know, give them welfare and give them handouts. And, you know, there's no integration. It's like having it's almost like having another country inside your country. Another culture inside your culture. Instead of assimilating them to the culture like, you know, we do here.
Yeah, and some people are now saying that it's racist to ask people to assimilate. It's like, I don't know where these people get off. The thing is, I don't really know the answer to your question. It might be something to do with the American dream. And for a long time, we saw, you know, people, Hispanic and so forth, coming to America, wrapping themselves in American flags and saying, I love this country. You know, I wanted my whole life to come here and things like that. But the thing is, the majority of Muslims in Great Britain are integrated. Do you know what I mean? The majority, it's not like the majority of Muslims here are going to go and commit violence. That's just not how it works. But the thing is, there's enough people who are causing trouble. And again, as you say, the West has not got its hands clean in these topics. Like the US, the UK has had a very close relationship with Saudi Arabia, the most oppressive, most tyrannical Islamic regime that opens these Wahhabi extremist schools all over the Middle East to teach the most radical and violent form of Islam. We've invaded Muslim countries and taken out secular dictators to make way for waves of extremist power and proselytize. So it's like, this is why I say it's suicide. It's not like the death of the West. It's like we've been pursuing at least in 1953 when the US took Mohammad Mossadegh out of power in Iran against our own interests. We intervened in Kosovo on behalf of a radical Islamic faction under the guise of saying, well, Slobodan Milosevic is terrorizing these people, when actually far more people were killed after the bombings, the NATO bombings began, than before. So it's not like I'm saying, it's so hard to look at this world when, and this is the problem we have, which is both the left and the right on this issue are correct on what they affirm, but they are wrong on what they deny. Between foreign intervention and blowback, and the left are denying the fact that if you go straight to the Islamic doctrine, if you read the biography of Muhammad, you will find a... Because people think that Islam is like Christianity. Christianity is the worship of God through Christ, right? They think that Islam is just the worship of Allah. It's not. Islam is the worship of Allah and the emulation of Muhammad. So if you want to know what Islam is all about, read the biography of Muhammad, because he's meant to have lived the perfect life and every Muslim should emulate him. But there's lots of violence in his life. He's doing it in lots of things. So therefore, you can find a pretext in that doctrine for violence. Now, people like my friend in the Scottish Libertarian Party has an interpretation of Islam, which he says is the correct one, which is everything needs to be taken in the context of the time when it was written. So yes, Muhammad did these things, but they were in the context of the time of jihad. Now, we're not in that time, therefore Islam is a religion of peace and so forth and what have you. But, and the more people who take that view, the better. That's great. And the unfortunate thing is I come back to the fact that out of 2 billion, believe in the more radical version, then that's enough to be worried.
I was going to mention, I read Scott Horton's book, Fool's Errand, and I started listening to it. He put it out on audiobook, and I've been listening to it all morning. And he points out in the first book, in the first chapter, the studies that have been done, and just by, you know, looking at the biographies of people that, you know, like committed the 9/11, the 19 on 9/11, and all sorts of suicide bombers. And it turns out a lot of these people are not even strictly religious. They're not.
Okay.
A lot of them aren't. A lot of them aren't Islamic fundamentalists. They're taking orders from people who can, who lean that way in many cases. But you know, a lot of these are actually highly educated in the West people who are doing this for political reasons. And they, you know, and sure, you know, just like moderate Christians, you know, every once in a while, I'll throw out a Bible verse to, you know, if someone asks me why I believe something, and I'll throw out a Bible verse to, you know, say, hey, look, you know, this is what Christ said to do. And I think it makes a lot of sense, and I'll do it. But I think that, especially since 9/11, a lot of the research that's been done is that, you know, a lot of these people who are committing some of the worst atrocities, even blowing themselves up, are doing it for politics, Bin Laden, how he referred to, you know, he didn't see a difference between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and all those other countries. They were, you know, that's like a holy triangle over there. And, you know, so he was, you know, he looked at it from a religious thing, but I mean, a bunch of the 9/11 hijackers were coke snorting, whoremongers. And these, you know, so it's, I think that in most cases, looking at blowback theory is very important. You can't, it can't be discounted. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there are Christians who have gotten violent and, you know, and decided they were going to, you know, they were going to do things under the guy, you know, under the guise of just cherry picking certain verses, you know, from the Bible, even from the New Testament. So I mean, I don't know if we can. There definitely has to, is there a section of Islam, and especially Wahhabism? I mean, I know that's very radical, but I mean, you've really seen that amped up and brought into the public eye, especially since OPEC was formed and since the United States and Saudi Arabia crawled in bed together, and you know the West is going to the East, and I mean, I can't, as many Muslims as I know who are just, you know, regular dudes who, you know, some were born here, some came here, and I mean, they're just really regular dudes, and they, you know, they're just going through life and working just like I am. It's, you know, and then looking at the facts of, you know, studies that have been done, and, I have a hard time painting Islam because, and one of the reasons why is because I know, I've studied the Bible, the whole Bible, Old Testament, New Testament. I know the New Testament really well. I mean, I went to seminary for a while, and I know that 90% to 95% of the Christians in the United States are not following that book. They're not, you know, the ones who are 95% who are going to church on Sunday, they're giving it lip service. It's tradition. It's not in their hearts. Right. So, you know, I really have to wonder how much it has to be the same with Islam, especially from what we've seen from some studies that have been done.
I'm not so sure. I mean, right. First of all, I call them cultural Christians. They're not necessarily true believers, or maybe they believe, but they don't fully embrace it because it's more, they're cultural Christians. I think that it's an evidence that Muslims, at least in the UK, I can't speak for the US, tend to be a lot more devout, and often even the younger generation is more devout. But the thing is, again, the UK is a very secular country compared to America. But yeah, I totally affirm what you're saying with the blowback stuff. I don't at all deny that. I mean, whenever anyone says to me, oh, it's nonsense, they're not, you know, the kind of Rudy Giuliani, are you saying, like, we're not, when Ron Paul said they're over here because we're over there, when anyone says that's a bunch of nonsense, I just say, well, look, it took one event, which was 9/11, to convince the American people to go to war on Afghanistan and Iraq, right? Which led on to Syria and Libya as well. I mean, that's one event. Just imagine if you lived in one of these countries where they're bombing all the time. Like, they've been bombing for years. So many grievances, right? So you can't deny the blowback effect. I mean, you would be pissed off, so pissed off if someone dropped a bomb on your, you know, on your house. I mean, pissed off is really like not even cutting it. Like, we can't imagine the horror of like your children dying in an explosion, or even the neighbors or someone you know. It's like, of course there's a blowback effect. It's impossible to deny. So I agree with you on this point, which is that we shouldn't be causing the problem in the first place. The only thing is that I think now that we unfortunately have caused the problem, it's like, how do we deal with the problem? Well, I guess you could put things in context and say, well, you're more likely to die in a car crash than true. But the risk of an Islamic terrorist attack is that then becomes the pretext for cracking down on civil liberties and the more fear mongering and more interventions abroad. It's a spiraling out of control. So I don't know. It's too mixed up. It's very hard to look at this world because we live in such a statist world. Like, it would be nice to look at individuals and individual actors, because we are individualists as libertarians, and yet the state forces us into these complex webs of problems created by coercion, which lead to other problems, and the inevitable response is, well, we need more coercion to solve that problem. You know, we've not bombed enough, obviously, if they're coming over here, so we're going to need to go and, you know, take out another regime to make the world safe for democracy, or make sure that, you know, I don't know, it's insane. Yeah, it just spirals out of control.
I mean, it's if you're bombing people, if you're bombing people, I mean, and one of the greatest pictures I ever saw was it was a modern jet fighter dropping a bomb on the Flintstones. And that's basically you know, what the West is doing, what Britain and, you know, and the United States together, they're bombing people back into the Stone Age who already almost, you know, some of them already live in the Stone Age, you know, and that's the way they choose to live.
Yeah, we can't.
Oh, okay. I was saying, no, go ahead. You were going to say something.
Sure. We can't even imagine the horrors of these wars. I mean, the Gulf War, them destroying power stations, leaving the hospitals without electricity, like the indiscriminate killing, the drone bombing in Pakistan, the starvation in Yemen. We are so freaking lucky to live in the countries that we live in. Could you imagine 24.5 million people living in North Korea? It's easy to get caught up in our problems, but like when I have a conversation like this, it really brings it home to me how lucky we are. And it's sad about the foreign interventions because you feel so powerless. I was at school when we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I went out to the anti-war protests, and there were so many people, but we were in favor of the anti-war protests is that it's possible that we I think it could be said for the protests is we might have prevented a third war. I think the Bush administration would have loved to have gone into Iran, but because the public didn't have an appetite for it, they weren't able to. So I don't know. I don't know how successful we were. It could have been a lot worse if we hadn't. It's a shame because under the Bush era, it looked like there was a big movement towards freedom and the liberation of humanity, a lot of protests about foreign policy, a lot of protests about the Patriot Act and the development of the surveillance state. And yet, all of that disappeared as soon as Obama got into office, leaving me to believe that it was not really a legitimate anti-war movement. It was more of an anti-Bush thing, an anti-Republican thing. So that's come back now under Trump, who I'm by no means a fan of. I've made my views on him very clear. But
what's come back?
The anti-right, you know, basically the anti-right movement.
Okay, I was going to say, yeah, the anti-right movement has definitely come back, but unfortunately, the anti-war movement from the left has not.
yeah, very unfortunate. In fact, if there's one thing the media gave Trump props for, it was for bombing Syria.
That's fucking crazy, man. That is insane.
Yeah, it's sad. It's sad. This is how far we've come. Now, I'm just hoping that we can do something to turn the tides, you know, that the next stage will be better than the last stage.
Yeah, it's, there was something else I wanted to ask about. Okay, so we've talked about what's happened with Count Dankula. We've talked about SJWs. We've talked about, you know, I mean, there is a problem with Muslim violence that's happening in Great Britain. If Britain just decides that they're going to still keep backing the U.S. when it comes to the wars, and they just keep going down this path. I mean, where do you see Great Britain? What are they going to look like in 20 years?
Well, that's quite a fearful thought. I mean, it could, basically what could happen in the West is the governments could go bankrupt, and then when people don't have their, can't pick up their welfare checks, which so many people are now dependent on, they riot, and then the only reaction to that is to institute a police state. That's how bad it could get. I think, hopefully that won't happen. I think the one thing that's doing us a lot of good in the world in terms of creating liberty is just the advanced technology has made everything so cheap that people can get by on a lot less. Like, I mean, without all the printing of money and the government intervening in the house market to keep house markets up and banning us from buying stuff from the poorest countries in the world with their trade barriers and their tariffs and all the ridiculous things, despite all 0% interest rates leading everyone to put money into the housing market, all of these things increase the cost of living. But despite all of those government interventions, okay, I could also mention the high rates of taxation, despite those government interventions increasing the cost of living, the cost of living has still managed to come down somewhat, and that's because of the advance of technology, thanks to what remains of the free market. With the advent of 3D printers and things like that, that may increase living standards of a degree that we might just get away with it. I don't know. It might make the cost of living so cheap that people don't really need to work for many hours to make a living. I mean, the average hour, number of hours worked has fallen by over 30 hours. Like, maybe not quite as much as that. I think it's about 36, 37 hours. It was typically 61 or over that on a farm, you know, before the Industrial Revolution and even during the beginning stages. So that was due to the advance of industrial processes that made everything cheap, you know, the advance of capitalism. So I'm hoping the technology will save us. Certainly, we've seen a massive reduction in poverty worldwide. In 2015, it was announced that less than 10% of the world's population was in abject poverty for the first time in history. Still a bit further to go. So we can hope that good things are happening. But of course, I'm in the personal development sphere, as some people know. And, you know, I advise that people take charge of their own life because, yes, the state is oppressive, but most of the oppression in your life are your own limits on yourself. You know, you can't be bothered taking exercise or eating well, so you're not in shape, so everything feels difficult. You self-criticize, you've got a dream, but you don't dedicate 20 minutes a day to pursuing your dream until you're used to doing that. So then you can bump it up to 40 minutes and then bump it up to an hour. You know, you've got arguments with your spouse, with your kids, with your neighbors. You don't pick up a book to learn communication skills so that you can get better at, like, these are areas that are really very much in your control. And if you take charge of what you can control, what you can't control becomes into your power. You learn some serious skills and wisdom. People do notice and they ask you, or you get the opportunity to pass on that and help other people around you become strong and stand on their own two feet. People, if you're not financially independent, that's a problem and something that's more of a constraint on you 9 times out of 10 than the government, because you can't even, you know, I don't know, something that would make you happy or get out of the country for a vacation and so forth. So all of these kind of topics is leading to a plug. In fact, I cover these kinds of things on the Be Yourself and Love It podcast. And I really encourage libertarians, because we're all about freedom, independent, to get into like their own life and making it the best they can, because it'll make you a positive influence on the people around you. And if the worst happens, you'll be so resourceful and skilled that you'll be a resource to people around you. You know, that's safety, security in a way. And you uplift the world when you uplift yourself. You can't help it. You're an influence on the people around you. You know, master yourself, master areas of your life, and then teach the people around you to do it. And the other bonus of that is people really listen to the people they admire. So by doing that, you become an admirable person, and it makes you a great advocate for libertarianism and liberty, and the world really needs our ideas right now.
I agree with everything you just said. That was well put. There is something I wanted to ask you about. A couple years ago, I want to say a couple years ago, but it could be as, I can't remember when it was. When did they have the Scottish independence vote?
It was a couple of years ago.
It was a couple of years ago. Okay. What, in your opinion, why do you think that didn't go through?
They didn't wait long enough. They should have held it back another 5 or 10 years, and it would have been inevitable just by demographics. The young people were far more pro independence than the older generation. Why did people, I don't know, I think the older generation just had more of an affinity for Britain. From a libertarian perspective, there's two ways of looking at it, and the libertarian community in Scotland is quite split over this. One is that, yeah, obviously having a smaller unit is more autonomy, and it's easier to get libertarian policies through a parliament in a country of 5 or 6 million than one of 60 million, 65 million. However, there's another side to the coin, which is that far more left-wing, far more status, far more big government than England is in their opinions. So some people believe Scotland would be a socialist hellhole, and they were unionists for that reason. They wanted to stay in the UK for that reason. Now, you could retort and say, well, Scotland isn't really going to be able to raise their council, their corporation tax much higher than England do, because all the businesses will just hop over the border. So it's a back and forth. But, that was just a bonus answer. I know that didn't directly speak to your question.
No, that's fine. Do you think, one of the things I wanted to ask is, do you think it was because, and you talked about how older people were definitely against Scottish independence. Do you think it has to do with that, the state retirement check, the state, just being addicted to the state teat,
they'd get far more in benefits from an independence from the UK at large, I would imagine, because people are more into that up here. There's good things. I mean, people are more anti-war, potentially more anti-nuclear weapons and things like that. Scotland was overwhelmingly against the war in Iraq. I think it's the young people want a change, right? And independence promises utopia. And it's like, if we were only independent, then we could. And you can pour all your dreams into that, then we could. No, I didn't even vote in the Scottish independence referendum. And the reason why is I didn't have a crystal ball. And I think it'd be arrogant of me to assume I knew which would be better. So I abstained. And it's like, I just felt that everyone was making their decision based on emotional affiliation, either to Scotland as a nationalist or to Great Britain as a nationalist. Personally, I feel both British and Scottish, even though I'm not a nationalist. I always say I was born in a piece of land, because if I wasn't, I would have drowned. So, I think that young people are fed up. It's hard to get a job. They've also been brought up to believe they're too good for work. Working in a cafe or a bar or like that somehow demeaning, and oh, it's so crap to have to work for a boss and so forth. The minimum wage is high, I would say, and there's lots of labor laws, so there's not a ton of job, and they do feel insecure about their future. The government's in huge amounts of debt. It's a hard time to be a young person, I think. It's like, in many ways, we're more abundant and we've got more freedom than our parents had or that our grandparents had. We're richer, but it's precarious because having lots of choices to make also means lots of responsibility. And this is something that about, but when I noticed that, I felt the need to share it, and I'll share it now. We don't actually realize how quickly we've had a transition where, in the space of a few hundred years, right, you did what your parents did, you lived what your where your parents lived, you married who your parents said, your income belonged to your, the fruit of your labor belonged to your feudal lord, there wasn't any class mobility. You had hardly any leisure time because you were working over 60 hours a day in a bar, right? Now we have responsibility for all of these areas. We've got responsibility for choosing our job, choosing our partner, getting along with our partner. We've got the responsibility of choosing what we do with our leisure time, which we've got lots of, and people sit and watch YouTube or Netflix, but they really have dreams that they're not pursuing and they feel bad about that because they're not as conscientious as they want to be. Every freedom we have in this sphere is a responsibility, and it's a stressful time to be alive, especially when they waste 11 to 13 years of your life in the mandatory education system where they teach you nothing that will help you go out and make an income for yourself. I mean, Jesus, 13 years is, sorry to take the Lord's name in vain. I know you're a Christian man.
You're not going to offend me, don't worry.
That's long enough to become a pianist. I don't believe that the only purpose of the education system is to prepare people for the workplace. But in all that time, you could have given everyone once $20 an hour for. Now, whether they're going to stay in that job is inconsequential. At least they've got the security of knowing that they can get paid that until they figure out what they really want to do with their lives. And, you know, being 20, 22 years old is not too late to figure out what you want to do with your life, you know. So the thing is, people are robbed outright of their childhood and teenage years in which they should be learning to become competent so that, you know, we've got this joke on the internet, I'm not ready to adult today. I'm not ready, you know, and it's a meme. But people genuinely feel like that. Millions and millions of people feel, I've just turned 30, I don't feel like an adult, I'm still not ready to have kids, I still don't know what I'm doing with my life, I'm underachieving for my level of intelligence. It's not really a joke, this, I don't feel ready to adult today. It's like, it's a serious social problem. And that's my long-winded answer to why I think that the youth are for Scottish independence, because they think that somehow independence alone will be a magic utopia of flowers and unicorns where they'll be able to engineer their perfect society. Well, the psychology of state.
Yeah, that's definitely not the proper motivation for wanting your independence. The proper motivation for wanting your independence is that you can stand up on your own two feet and you can take care of yourself and the people you love. I mean, it's just,
yeah, and it would be the opposite.
Yeah, and that's, and I, you know, I love what you said about, I honestly, you know, I believe libertarians, if you're going to call yourself a libertarian, especially if you're going to call yourself an anarchist, you better be, you know, you better be successful at whatever you choose to do. You know, it's incumbent upon it's incumbent upon you to do that. Because if you're not, you're just a faker. I mean, we're the group that says, you know, we believe that the free market can provide everything. Well, what are you what's your contribution to the free market? You know, I mean, it's too much like people are playing, it's almost like there's some people that are just playing some people that are just playing libertarian or playing anarchists. So why don't you, I'll give you a couple minutes to wrap up and, say anything, any other messages you got for us?
Yeah, I would just like to say, please download my free ebook, Procrastination Annihilation, from beyourselfandloveit.com/do it. It's a great book. It only takes 2 hours to read, so you won't need to put it off. And it's got links to my YouTube channel, my podcasts, anything you want to know about me is in the book. And you can feel free to email it to anyone that you know that suffers procrastination. Even if you're not a procrastinator, there's definitely some good tips in there. And becoming more productive and organizing your time better. So that's the only thing. If people want to follow me, I'd love it if you downloaded my free ebook. You'll find everything else in there.
Well, Anthony, this is a conversation where I actually felt, for the first time in a while, doing a podcast where I actually had a real conversation where, we went back and forth and we talked, we talked about challenging things, things that, people don't want to talk about. And, it sounds like we probably agree on like 95%. And, we just need to discuss that other 5% and, try and figure out if we can come up with a solution for it that, that works for everybody. So, especially amongst anarchists, I mean, it's the meme, status are gonna state. The more that us as anarchists, libertarians, voluntarists, however we wish to describe ourselves, the more that we can come together on certain things and talk them out, it's so much better for what we're trying to accomplish. So I really appreciate talking to you today. And, I hope one of these days that I can talk to you and your co-host on your show and, see if we can hash some stuff out.
Yeah, I'd love that, myself. Thank you so much for having me on Free Man Beyond the Wall. And I really enjoyed the conversation too. And I loved how we covered such a diverse range of issues. And I hope that your listeners enjoyed my appearance. So thank you so much for that.
No problem. Everybody, tune into it's the Scottish Liberty Podcast. I got that right?
That's it.
Awesome.
That's it. That's.
All right, man. It was great talking to you. You take care.
You too.
I want to thank you for tuning into the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Anthony for coming on today. I want to remind you about my book, Freedom Through Memedom. It's available on Amazon. I'll be coming back at you on the weekend with another podcast. So have a great week. Take care. Bye.